Monday, February 15th at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will air a Valentine's Day special to bring to light the fact that, because of incarceration, many people are separated from their friends, family, and lovers on Valentine's Day. We will be reading your short messages to your friends and loved ones on air. So whether you are behind bars and reaching out, or are out and reaching in, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our email address is kbooppc@gmail.com, and our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Address your messages to Prison Pipeline Collective. Then tune in on February 15th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read on air.
Want to connect KBOO on your smartphone? Now you can with the free KBOO mobile app available for both iPhones and Android devices. With the app, you can listen to KBOO live wherever you are, continuously streaming whether your phone is locked or not. Listen to our latest audio uploads. See when your favorite programs come on with our schedule. Check out our community events calendar. Read our monthly newsletters. Everything is available in one place, including posts from our Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube feeds. You don't need an account to see what's going on at KBOO. Have KBOO at your fingertips anywhere you happen to be with our new mobile app. Look up KBOO in iTunes or Google Play to download the free KBOO mobile app. Radio.
And just one of the many innovations made possible by the support of members of the KBOO Foundation, who have, many of whom went to kboo.fm and clicked on the cartoon jar that reads Donate Today. And this is KBOO Portland. It's 11:01 a.m. Coming up is the pilot edition of Pacific Underground, putting a microphone in front of local Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. And you know, another big thank you due to this program being made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from True West presenting Nashville-based band The Wood Brothers with Chris Wood of Modesky Martin and Wood Saturday, January 30th at the Roseland Theater in downtown Portland. The Wood Brothers perform with Liz Weiss, and tickets and information are available at cascadetickets.com. Let's check in now with Pacific Underground.
You're listening to Pacific Underground, a show where Asians and Pacific Islanders in Oregon take the mic into our own hands. I'm Alan Montecilio.
And I'm Pamela Santos.
This is our first show. It's finally here. I'm so excited that this is finally happening. Now, this has been in development for a while now. I think the first time we met to talk about this was about 5 or 6 months ago. So, what are we doing here? What is the show?
Well, there are nearly 225,000 Asians and Pacific Islanders, otherwise known as APIs, in Oregon. There was an API public affairs show on KBOO before.
Shout out to APA Compass.
But it went off the air in June of 2015. So in one of America's whitest states, the issues that impact us simply aren't getting covered in the media.
It's worth noting, too, that this isn't just one of the whitest states in the nation. It's also one of the fastest growing states.
Right. And we see a real need for Asians and Pacific Islanders to have a public platform to tell our stories. So we'll be playing interviews, documentaries, audio essays, performances, as well as real-time coverage of national, social, economic, and political issues affecting APIs in your local community.
For this first episode, you've recorded 2 interviews with Asian American artists. So, who's up first?
So this is an interview with Christina Wong. She's a theater artist, I would like to consider internet celebrity, an all-around social justice activist.
K-Boo.
K-Boo. We can keep saying it.
K-Boo. That's the new by Felicia.
We're going to listen to a sample of the Wall Street Journal.
Okay. I'm Asian. Surprise! And to my parents' grave disappointment, I am not a Wall Street trader nor captain of industry. I am a performance artist who fights for the marginalized. And here is where I do my best work. The armchair. And this is what I use to take them all down. The iPad. Christina, you cannot have an existential crisis right now. Existential crises are for those women who read, eat, pray, love. I'll go to hashtag Africa.
I miss the rains down in Africa.
The dark continent. Brought to you by white people. You know, here we call you Mzungu. That is Swahili for white person.
White privilege.
White privilege!
I rock the first iPhone. It's like a spaceship here, but a joke back at home. It's like I'm the Asian Oprah. Through African eyes, I'm the big white Oprah.
A lot of, I want to say, I'm going to call it your recent artwork. Your recent, you're a theater artist.
My new show?
Yes.
The Wall Street Journal.
So the Wall Street Journal, but also I almost feel like I've been seeing it unfold on Facebook as you went through your process.
Yeah, I'm going to write this show.
Yeah, so there's this kind of social media aspect to it.
Yeah.
And a lot of... that particular Asian American Civil War was also, you know, it had a lot to do with activism. It had a lot to do with intersectionality. Mm-hmm. And I think the takeaway that I had from it is something that actually came from probably themes you dealt with in your show, which is, you know, what are we actually accomplishing here?
Yeah. Well, can I set a backdrop?
Yes,
describing
please.
Describing something
please,
that nobody
please,
else
please.
Has seen. So the Wall Street Journal is my fifth solo show. I had been touring quite a few. I've never toured the Pacific Northwest. So if no one here has heard of me, that's why. Because I'm coming in the fall with the Wall Street Journal. I don't have a date yet, but Boom Arts is presenting me. And I had toured a show called Wong Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That is a long-running show that I still tour in excerpts about the high rates of depression and suicide among Asian American women. I started touring that in 2006. I still tour it. So you imagine 9 years living with a show about that topic, even a very funny show, which this was, is pretty killer. And it was killing my psyche. And I didn't know who I was anymore. I was becoming the character of Christina Wong that I portray in the show, if that makes any sense. I did two follow-up shows, one called Going Green the Wong Way, another called Cat Lady. Both of them, I was performing versions of myself. And I was like, I hate this. I hate feeling like a human VCR. I am jaded by theater. And I was like, I'm going to Africa. I don't know why. I've never gone. I'm just going to do a show. I've never even been to China, which is in theory my motherland, right? My grandparents immigrated from China. I've never been. And admittedly, that was a very entitled eat, pray, love moment that I had, which we are not allowed to have as people of color, right? As strong, radical people of color, we're not allowed to have eat, pray, love moments, right? Because that is reserved for people who read that book and for white women who are panicking about their lives, right? But no, I was panicking about my life and I needed to find myself in that sort of setting. And so I signed on to volunteer with a microloan organization that gave microloans to women affected by the Ugandan Civil War, which ended in 2006. And I ended up making a rap album while I was there with local rappers. I also found myself really not sure how to exist, because in America, I do a lot of shows about being marginalized. In that moment, I was getting in a lot of fights with people on Twitter about essays I had written, and people were accusing me of stuff. And it was just like, and I would fight right back. And it was like sort of this thrill, because the more I fought on Twitter, the more followers I gained. And I show up there where I am a Mzungu. I am that's the word they use for white people. I am of privilege. I have, even in my poorest here, I have so much over there. And I did not know how to best wield that privilege because there was no invisible oppressor in the room to blame the way you can on Twitter. You can't blame structural racism. Like, you can, but I don't see what the point is because you're face-to-face, you know, with people who are on the bottom end of your privilege. And I had to figure out how to best exist and make a rap album and work with people and wield my privilege. And that's the story of the Wong Street Journal. And it's something I'm still dealing with now. It's like, yeah, I could keep yelling at people in the room who aren't there and say, this, because it is the result of inequity and racism, structural racism, that Africa has gotten the bottom end of it. But also what I witnessed there is that the narrative we've painted in the West of Africa is of, like, save the children and, oh God, these people are so helpless and everyone has AIDS and they're in war. And that is not necessarily what that is not, you know, yes, there's AIDS, yes, there's war, but there's chaos, but there is also people working very hard. There are people who are self-determining their own futures. There are people starting their own businesses. And that narrative is completely erased because of this narrative that we are the only ones who can save them, white saviorhood, that if we show up there, we can fix it, mm-hmm. which is not the case.
So when I was living in New York, I volunteered for UN for Women.
Yeah.
And I did kind of experience this crisis of conscience that we weren't doing things to just, let's say, focus on people in the South Bronx or women, primarily African-American women, are at high risk for HIV.
Yeah.
So we're not even doing any of that. It's just like, oh my gosh, Africa. Oh my gosh,
yeah.
Philippines. Oh my gosh, let's do all of these things to help these programs here.
Yeah.
So I didn't know how to navigate that.
I think it's tricky, right? Because we definitely have so many problems at home, and we keep talking about, I don't know, we keep talking about, but the narrative is constantly, oh, save those poor countries. Mm-hmm. We need to save ourselves. It's not to say we should not be helping other people, but we got to check our own stuff, like, mm-hmm. how, like, there's 43 million people living in this country under the poverty line, right? Is that acceptable? And I think it was probably Trump, he was criticizing how North, maybe it was Carson, they're all the same at this point. they were, during the GOP debate, they were criticizing how North Korea is building a military and not feeding the hungry. And I'm like, in ways, you could say we're doing the same thing. We're building a military, but not putting money into schools or to getting people out of poverty. It's a different extreme, but
no, we're actually doing that. We are literally doing that, yeah, on a actually larger scale. We have, like, the largest defense budget,
yeah,
in the world.
Yeah.
And our education levels are...
Yeah, I taught a class at CalArts. I was an adjunct. I did not get paid a lot of money, as glamorous as it sounds. I mean, I was actually being paid kind of high for an adjunct, and it was an insane amount of work. And I can't... I just think my hat's off to teachers, like, who are working 40 hours a week and they're running, you know, teaching how many classes, and then they have a grading load. And I was just like, how are we not paying teachers millions of dollars? Like, this is this is insane work to prep a future. I mean, if that motivation's not there, how are you gonna, you know?
And especially when you're face to face with the future, you're basically looking at, well, I would even put it, you're looking at two faces of the future. You're looking, yeah, at whatever these kids are potentially going to be, and then what, depending on your influence on, yeah, them, yeah, this. Do you feel like your art is your kind of way to do some of that social change work?
I don't know how I became political in the work. I think I just find especially with theater, when you work on something so long, it needs to be about something. In theater, I really craft my shows. Like, a lot of people will know me from the essays I've written, what I call clickbait essays, like 9 whack things white guys say to deny their Asian fetish. Like, they think that that's the start and end of all I do. I do a lot of things that, like, obviously, Wong Clover the Cuckoo's Nest was a pretty intense procedure to create. And I just feel like things, if you're going to spend so long on something, they have to be about something bigger than yourself, and all the ways life intersects. I spent years working on shows and researching it, and I just feel like you, like me in front of an audience, that is a political act, right? I am a marginalized person they haven't seen before, and that's a big deal. Like, I'm going to take up space and time, and I'm right here. So it
kind of brought this back to me when I watched Wong Street Journal. It was on Fuse, I think.
Fusion,
thank you. Look at that. Yeah. I don't even know. It's the new channel. Was it the channel or the show was called Fusion?
No, the channel's called Fusion. And the show is Alicia Menendez.
Thank you.
Tonight, I think.
I thought it was one of those, you know, the new MTVs.
Oh, there's so many new channels.
That's what I'm saying.
So many new channels.
That's why.
That's one of them. But they're actually really interesting. I don't want to go into personal stuff, but I went did a meeting there, and like, I was shocked. It was the only pitch meeting I've ever been to where I walk in and there's a dry erase board and it's filled with words like police brutality, intersectionality.
Yes.
Like, I was like, did you steal this from a union office? I've never been to a television network where such progressive terms were on a blackboard. And I was like, feminist Christmas for me. I was like, is this seriously a TV meeting? Because, like, usually when I'm in those settings, I have to, like, turn down the activists and be like, I'm just an entertainer. Hey, I'm so cute. Like, that's usually the strategy that I use when I do meetings. And it was, like, so great because I could just talk as myself and just be radical and political. And they loved it. But yeah, that was after I did the appearance on their show.
And, so I pictured, like, yeah, you can make, you know, car modeling a radical act when you know, like, hawk a loogie on, like, people. Like, you're really good at the sound of it, actually. It's really, like, just like, oh, I gotta practice it for me. But I'm just like, no, you've gotten it.
Yeah, damn. No, I grew up, my grandma used to, we didn't live in Chinatown, but my grandma used to take me to Chinatown to go grocery shopping. And so I witnessed it a lot. And, you know,
I did not expect that.
Yeah, so the Fusion TV appearance you're referencing, for those who don't know, is I was asked after my essay about Asian fetish came out to talk about there's some statistic on an app, Are You Interested, that revealed that Asian women across the board were preferred by men of all races. And so someone who worked at the app and me were being interviewed, and they wanted to get my opinion on it as Asian women. And this is right. This is the situation that we often find ourselves in, is, hey, can you talk about race in a fraction of 6 minutes? And I was just like, I was on my scooter riding up to the studio going, God, I hate this. I don't know how to do this. There's nothing like big or meaningful that I can do in that short amount of time. And I was like, this is a new station. No one's going to even watch this. So I was like, what if I, you know, so this is what I always ask myself as a comedian. All right. Okay. Like, cause I have screwed up interviews before when I've just tried to talk very logical, like an academic around it. And I'm not an academic. I've done a lot of reading. I'm smart, I think. But, you know, like, I was just like, how am I going to handle this situation? And this is where I'm basically this token. I was like, okay, well, what's good about the situation? And that's what I ask. As a comedian, you always have to think, okay, what are the two? There's always the first two obvious ways you go about it. What's the third answer around it? So one is, I could be like, no, this is awful. Yuck, yuck. You don't get it. No, no, no. And be that screaming woman who then loses her voice. And then the second is just be like, yeah, it's fine, I guess. And then the third is just to completely, like, what is it?
I have it in my head.
At first, it was sort of upsetting because I feel like it just feeds into this the fetishization of Asian women and the sort of the stereotype that Asian women are these submissive, delicate model girlfriend types. But as I thought about it, I took a moment and I was like, suck it, white ladies. I got it. I had to live under your shadow all through high school, and now I'm the hottest thing on earth, and I can do anything, and some crazy white guy will still like this.
Yeah, delicious. Who would not want a piece of that?
It was just like, wow, how is this a good thing? How can I go over the top? Like, I won the lottery. And I, so I told the producer there, like, I'm looking into a box with a camera, so I can't see anybody. Mm-hmm. I didn't get to see what it looked like after. I didn't get to see the funny graphics and stuff that they used. I didn't get to see the guy's face. So I'm just, I just found all these props backstage, a Viking helmet, compressed air in a can. I found all that backstage and I just put them in order. I'm like, okay, I'm going to blow my nose. I'm going to spit. And then I'm going to blow my face. Like, I was just like an improv actor. It's like, go more and more crazy. And just the whole thesis here is I won the game. Suck it, white ladies. I got it. And look at all the stuff I can get away with because now statistically somebody wants this. And then the clip went viral. And I think actually more people saw the clip than actually watched the broadcast. and then it led to a lot of stuff. I ended up on a reality show for Mix TV, and my episode was called I'm Asian American and I Want Reparations for Yellow Fever. And I don't think anyone watched that because they don't have their episodes on YouTube. They have it on this on there. So you've got to be able to dig through the website and find this dumb episode.
We could only get the clips.
Yeah, I know.
I could only see
that. And then
that
led to the New York Times. And, you know, the thing is I'd been doing work forever. It's just... Mm-hmm. You know, you had to have been there to see it. And so all this weird Asian fetish stuff led to this whole resurgence and people finding my work. And I'm, you know, whatever it takes. I feel like that's, I accept like that, you know, people are going to find me how they find me. And what I'm going to be remembered for is not necessarily what I would have liked to be remembered mm-hmm. for. I would love to be remembered for the Wong Street Journal. But that might not happen in my lifetime, right? Because mm-hmm. it's theater. And, I can't rely even on an Asian audience to come out to theater. Like, my friends came to my show and they're like, wow, you got a lot of white people here. I'm like, it's theater. Like, that's you think Asian people are clamoring to leave their houses and come, you know, like some are really excited to see other Asian artists, but for the most part, you know, it's and I love my white audience members. I'll just put that out there. Some of my best audience members are white people. I love them. So it's just I'm just happy to get them out there because that is how I continue to make my livelihood is my live work. Mm-hmm. So if it means these dumb videos get them out, then that's what it is.
Well, considering that there's just so many facets of you, I think we've kind of talked about activist Christina Wong. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the Christina Wong that writes about Asian fetish mm-hmm. and all of the, I think what gets kind of lost underneath it all mm-hmm. is that artists like Christina Wong, like people looking at what you're doing.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it's really easy. We are in an era of the short attention span mm-hmm. and it takes so much to like get people to hang on for like now viral videos can't even be a minute. You know, it's just it's too much time.
Yeah. Do you have your vines ready? Are your vines all
vines
good?
And I think what's interesting, too, is stuff like Snapchat and Periscope, which people are like, are you on that? Are you on that? I'm like, I feel like the digital realm is trying to replicate the ephemerality of theater. It's just like, just come to see theater. If you want to see something that disappears and it's a much better experience, just come to theater. But instead, people want... I don't know who's watching people narrate their meal, which is what I feel like a lot of Periscope videos are. And I'm just like, what? I've got this thing. It's called Leaving the House. You all want to do that? So it's a tricky thing. And it's what I talk a lot about in the Wong Street Journal. It's mm-hmm. like I really felt like there was no audience for nuance anymore. And my career became chasing likes and shares and hits. And I just was really disenchanted with it all as an artist. I didn't feel like an artist anymore. I just felt like someone who was getting into fights online or angering people. Because that was the stuff that was hitting the most is when I... And it wasn't that I was purposely looking to anger people, but usually around race or talking about white privilege mm-hmm. would just hit a lot of nerves. And that's where I found relevance. Because being reasonable on the internet doesn't... Nobody listens to reason. Mm. I mean, this is an aside, but I was watching the GOP debate and Rand Paul points out to everybody, no, you cannot just kill civilians because then the UN will get involved. And I'm like, wow, he's the most reasonable person on the stage. And I had no respect for him before this point. How is Rand Paul the most reasonable guy on this stage right now? So ridiculous, you know.
He has his one moment of clarity. I mean, his one moment of lucidity.
Well, it's just that no one else there is being reasonable. They were all like, kill him, kill him, kill him. You know, we have to do mercy killings. That was Ben Carson. It's a mercy killing to kill. If we get the girlfriends and whatever of the killers and of the terrorists, then we can get them. I mean, it was just.
So something I've learned, God knows, everybody knows I'm a New Yorker. I say it all the time. But coming to Portland and coming to the Pacific Northwest, if you can't talk about race in like pretty much a lot of places in America.
Yeah, I feel nervous too. Like right now, like going, oh, don't scare the white listeners off. Like, and it's not that I'm saying something to attack you. I'm just pointing out my truth and how I'm experiencing things. Like can we tell the Silverado story?
Yes.
Okay. So
I was ready for it.
So I was here for a conference and then I stayed, I'm doing Livewire, which will have aired by the time this airs. I'm doing Livewire and PRI. And my friend Suzanne's like, there's a male strip club across the street. I'm like, yeah, let's go. Because I love Magic Mike. It's my guilty pleasure. I'm not even into dudes who are all muscly like that, but something about Channing and that pony dance.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the sort of this fantasy of like, wow, can I just be the one getting pleasure without feeling threatened or whatever?
Okay.
Can I just enjoy, like, and for me, that's what the male strip club is. It is this place where I, in theory, believe that I could temporarily, through capitalism, by me having the dollar in my hand, temporarily suspend the current reality, which is a world that is racist, has been founded on white supremacy, is one where women are have to live in fear, cannot expose their own sexuality without being punished for it. It is this temporary world I have decided where that can happen. And so this utopia is the Silverado Strip Club in downtown Portland. And so I go in and it's mostly old men who are the patrons. And it's a mix, I guess, of straight and queer dancers, male dancers. And this one guy, Austin, who is white. I wasn't sure if he was white, but it became very clear he was white because it's pretty dark in there. He shakes my hand and he's very cute. And he's like, really like, hey, I'm Austin. I'm like, oh, hi. Like, I you know, it's sort of a turn on when you feel like, oh, I sort of shattered his work wall and he's actually attracted to me. And he's like, we do lap dances here for $20. And I was like, okay. And he's like, and then he, and like, there's like an immediate like, hey, and then he's like, I love my Asian customers. And I was just like, oh, okay. Was that ironic? Like, I was just like, did he just say that ironically? Cause that's not a turn on when someone, declares that you are part of an othered group that they love so much. And, but I'm like, well, is that okay in this environment where he's working and he's the one objectified for cash? And so, okay, whatever. So he's obviously straight because he's the worst dancer on the floor. Like, can I just say that? Worst dancer. Just sort of shaking. Like, you know, and he's like flashing the junk. He's flashing the junk. I'm like, which is not impressive either. But he's like totally blowing me kisses from across, like just me. And, you know, there's something flattering about like, oh, he could be just, I could just be a dollar sign right now. But like he's actually feeling the love for me. And then he's like begging my friend, we're going to walk out. And he's begging my friends, please let me give her a lap dance. Please, please. And I was like, okay. And then he was like, thank you so much for letting me give you a dance. Oh my God. Thank you. Like he was so grateful. And then he's like, I love Oriental girls.
Oh my God. No.
And I'm like, oh my God, are you like 120 years old inside of a stripper's body? Like, what kind of diversity training are they doing here at the Silverado Male Strip Club? Like, who's using this word? And then I go, and then I'm like, whoa, you can't use that word, bro. Like I've not heard that word in so long. I feel like for the most part, white men have learned you don't say the word Oriental, and you specifically don't say what he did saying next. My last girlfriend is Asian. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, we don't, like, when you break up with an Asian woman, their spirit does not die and get reincarnated in another Asian woman. We're actually different people, and I don't need, I'm not here to be the memory of your last girlfriend. And like, I could have walked away, but I have this thing too about sex work where I want to honor the work of sex workers. So I'm just really confused because I had agreed to this lap dance. And then I am also like, I could just walk away. And this is that clueless racism, right? Where it's like, it's not like he's like, I hate Orientals. He says, I love Orientals, but that's still racist, right? That's still racist still language. Like, it's still othering. It's still
it's like a racism, like, filling in there.
It's seeing me as part of a collection, right? Of women to be collected, right? And I opt for the side of, like, I'm going to educate him during the lap dance. So I'm there in this, like, booth that... there's no one else getting a lap dance. I'm in the booth, and there's two pieces of cheap fabric on each side to give us privacy. And he's like, you can put your hands anywhere except for down my briefs. And I'm just like, that's fine, because I don't. And I feel nothing. I am drier than a desert during this lap dance. And it, like, is junk is pounding into my belly button. And I'm like saying, you know, you can't use that word Oriental. And he's just like, I'm sorry. But, like, it doesn't feel like a real sorry. You know, it's just like.
It's like a. Like a thrust, sorry. Like,
yeah, and like, I'm literally being oppressed into my belly button, into my navel, into my last point of connection with my mother. And I am, you know, here's the thing. It's like, it's not enough to just say, I'm sorry, because that just teaches white people, okay, these are the words you don't say. It doesn't mean that they aren't thinking thoughts. They aren't, like, looking at Asian women and going, that specimen, so exotic, you know. And I'm just... I'm just so confused here, because it's just been so long since someone has just outright said those things to my face. Because what I find living in Los Angeles is just men with Asian fetish, they've gotten really clever about it. So even if they've had a long line of Asian women, they don't tell you. You pick it up. You figure it out when it's too late.
When you're in their lair.
Or like... You know, just these details about their exes, and you're like, that was an Asian woman. And then you go, oh, I see. I'm part of an assembly line. I'm part of an assembly line of blow up dolls that you have, like, and you will just replace me with another Asian woman when I don't fulfill the expectations of the sweet, quiet Asian woman that you had wanted.
Oh my God.
You know?
And I think we're on the same page about that. Is there anything you want to let people know? Anything else that you're doing that you want to announce? Or what's next after this?
I have a web series rolling out in 2016. I'm not sure where it's landing, if we're going to be able to get it licensed by another site. But you can look up the Christina Wong web series. I don't even want to give you the name yet because it's so top secret. But there's a lot of amazing Asian American women and feminists who are part of it. And it's hilarious. It's going to be so fun.
It's amazing.
And it's going to roll out in 2016. So if you just subscribe to youtube.com/Christina Wong, Christina with a K, you should be able to start seeing some of the preview clips from that.
And all of your other, all the social media facets that people can find you.
Yeah.
So you're on also.
I'm on everything except Snapchat, and I don't use Periscope. I feel like if I use it while I'm walking, I'll trip on the sidewalk.
Well, you're definitely on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. That's the main ones.
Instagram, yeah, those are big ones. Those are the big corporations that own all my data.
And the algorithms and such.
And my algorithms, yeah.
So I'm excited. I'm excited for people discovering, if they haven't already by now, discovered Christina Wong.
Yep. Find me on Bumble, too. I'm on Bumble and Tinder.
Temporarily, for a little.
Just the feminist research.
Absolutely. It's going to be a new show, you know, in what, 2018? No.
The show is now. Is Christina trying to date with a public persona.
As long as everyone is okay with, you know, Instagramming your dates. As long as everyone's okay with that.
As long as you're okay with being in a show.
In some way, they know it. Artist life. Artist. Thank you so much again, Christina. And I'm so excited.
Thank you for having me. We finally have met in person.
I know. We actually can cross off a
Except
non-
you guys, you're sick and you won't let me hug you. So I'm like, you could be a digital bubble or hologram that just drove me.
I wanted to just give you an air fist bump. Lady, ooh.
boss lady. Ooh.
This is KBOO Portland, and I am pleased and privileged to remind you that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from True West, presenting an evening with Phish bassist Mike Gordon and his band February 2nd at the Crystal Ballroom. Mike Gordon is joined by Scott Murawski, Craig Myers, Robert Walter, and John Kimmock. Tickets and information for Mike Gordon at the Crystal Ballroom on February 2nd are available at cascadetickets.com. We'll go right back now to more of Pacific Underground, right here on KBOO Portland, your community radio.
That was Christina Wong talking with Pamela Santos. The song you're hearing right now is from Christina's rap album, if you can believe it, produced with Nario in Uganda. Now we're going to stay on the topic of Asian American artists, and Pam, you did this interview as well.
Yes, this is with my friend, Filipino American poet Reggie Cabico. He is a multi-award-winning and just kind of renowned poet in the slam poetry scene since he first debuted at the New Yorkian Cafe in New York City. He's based in D.C., and he just happened to be in Portland.
Nina, look at the sky. April clouds hang a fat, sappy syrup on my saddest day. Played you Monday night, my day unbearable as a wool coach in April. Came back to find my bed empty as a tire swing in winter. Nina, in my saddest hour, you have crooned me over a cruel block of loneliness when unrequited love is an Italian bartender who flirts with you from the torso and offers you more lies than a tiramisu. Yes, Nina, Monday night I was so terribly sad, sadder than a parlor of long veils, carrying groceries up too many flights of stairs. And the sound of your voice, so full and broad-shouldered, made the day with all its drama into bangles and diamonds. Nina, you made me a culinary priestess. You placed a bojangling spell on me, singing above the sizzling oil as I pranced like a tiger among the tambourines and tin cans. The raindrops applauded, and the single wine glass wept because I found my inner Nina. Nina, Nubian Mona Lisa, woman painted with Egyptian mascara. You use silence the way a woman's figure made Jesus bend at the knees. Bend, ache, break to the will of your beautifully blessed contralto, crackling bittersweet as you held a phrase long enough for green finches to fly out the winter gloom. Nina, the storyteller. Nina, a river lonely as hell. Nina, tossed like an ark full of sparrows. You can honky-tonk the bones off Kali and steal the lightning from her toes. Listen, Nina, I think it's going to rain again. Human kindness is overflowing, flowing harder, even in the cruelest times. Well, first of all, I never wanted to be a spoken word poet. I thought I would be in Miss Saigon, but Leah Salonga took my part. So I was just tired of never being Asian enough in the early 90s, which, you know, we've evolved, or at least, you know, but there's still a lot of work to do. But, you know, I was never Asian enough into what casting people wanted me to be. I got fired from shows, and I'm like, until I actually wrote and I actually performed what it is that I wrote, I was able to just reclaim my my own identity and to have my own artistic power. I mean, nobody's going to tell me, oh, you can't be on stage. And if that's the case, I will make my own stage. I will be in coffee houses. I'll perform in bars. I'll perform in schools. And so that's really what spoken word is for me. There's a part of me that wanted to be a preacher priest because I wanted to be on the pulpit and like give sermons. So I feel like being a spoken word poet is sort of like my spiritual spell on you all, where I get to be queer and super Filipino and super funky. So without the rise of spoken word at the Eurekan Poets Cafe in 1993, I don't think, who knows, I might be a lawyer or a massage therapist. So yeah, but that is the power of the word. And I wrote because nobody wanted to hear a Filipino-American experience in the 70s in Clinton, Maryland, where it was 50% redneck and 50% African-American. Where do I go? What do I do? You know? And so I feel like I suppressed my whole identity during high school and just in middle school and elementary school. You suppress your identity, and at some point you're just going to have to explode.
I think there was such a huge jump or a leap for me going from, I want to call them almost like dusty poems, like, oh, here are the odes of Shakespeare, here are the Bard and John Donne and this and this and this. Yeah. And there wasn't... definitely in schools, I really don't think they do too much in letting people, probably other than maybe Maya Angelou, they don't get into contemporary poets at all.
They don't. I think things are changing. I think this country is afraid of poetry. People under, and I teach at Bellevue Hospital, so people know art therapy and they know music therapy, but poetry, like, what are you doing with poetry? It's so weird, it's scary, because it's not like we get like poetry, you know, on radio stations. It's not like we have that on our top 40. It's not used that way. So I think that the way that schools teach it, I totally didn't like it. Like, what am I going to, why am I reading Emily Dickinson? Like, why? Like, you know, has she auditioned, you know, you know, like, what has she done? So it's sort of like people don't understand poetry. But I think it's changing now. And I think that we are creating a culture in schools where poetry is going to be relevant to students' lives. And for me, poetry for high school students, it's where they can be rebellious and where they can actually be passionate and they can be truthful. So a lot of my work is also teaching youth as well. And that has been, I never thought I'd be doing this. I never, ever thought that I would be an educator. Never thought that I would be, you know, writing poetry. It was just not, I just thought I would just be this actor doing like Shakespeare plays. What I've been thinking now is, and it's a term now, is erasure. And how our work, our bodies, our identity is a race. And you see this in casting when Scarlett Johansson plays an Asian character, you know, and you're seeing the whitewashing. And I'm also seeing it as an educator when I go to schools and fifth graders, they are not focused on writing. The focus is reading and math, and they don't have any kind of writing focus. I'm thinking, wow, these are students of color who are not taught to write, which means that I don't exist. I don't put a mark on the wall. So I'm seeing this whole thing of erasure now. It's in my consciousness, and I think that's the next phase of what I want to talk about, and erasure in my life as a Filipino in DC. I mean, but I think it can be funny. I think erasure can be funny. And I've always been about the humor. I think we have to laugh. Like, the only way you can be funny is if you really accept it. Then you can be funny. I think that's why it's hard to be funny, because you have to accept the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I've, like, it's not that I've accepted the pain. It's more like I've sort of, it's been normalized. And now I'm thinking of erasure. And in my whole 20 years, erasure mm-hmm. moments, like small moments of erasure. Like when an usher says, "Are you Hawaiian?" And I'm like, "No, I'm Filipino." And she goes, "Well, in our theater company, we did Beauty and the Beast. And our Belle, she was Chinese." And like, okay. All right, so why? Like, so, okay, good. I'm glad you have a Chinese Belle.
Yeah.
How? And I think we could do it in a comedic way. And I think that poetry is so serious sometimes. But I think... there's nothing wrong with being funny. There's nothing wrong with being entertaining. And so humor, I think, is underlooked.
Well, humor is its own kind of therapy.
And Filipinos are funny. Filipinos are OA. We're overacting, but it's also from the OA, there is this humor. And I think that's part of who I am. My Filipino humor is a big part of my identity. So to be funny, I think, it's key, because Filipinos have been through the worst.
And keep on and keep on, right?
And we laugh.
I'm sorry, but I have to even
cackle,
say,
right?
There's like, for all of the things that different Filipinos go through, it's almost like, I think if people didn't know what Filipinos were like, that would almost feel like the humor that people have after the super typhoon, things that, you know, people go through. But what are you going to do? You know, I think I've noticed, especially with pretty much whether they're born in the Philippines or they came from, because they're mm-hmm. also still absorbing that from their own, like, families and from earlier generations, the humor gets passed down.
Right, right.
And it's also something to either, sometimes it's a mask, sometimes it covers the hurt, sometimes it's a way to sweep the hurt, and then sometimes it's just a way to show probably that you're hurt, but you're going to laugh at the same time. It's really hard that I think people, I get told all the time about, oh, you're so funny, oh, this, or whatever could be, I think, maybe comparisons of what they wanted to box me in with, maybe East Asian women and stereotypes of East Asian women.
I'm like, screw that.
I guess maybe the major themes that... I've gotten from not even just your old poems, but especially your new work. You have is it a chapbook?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and your chapbook is called "The Perfect Guy: Poems by Reggie Cabico," and I think a lot of it has to do with you're able to write gay male sexuality, and in some ways, that's something that, first of all, how are you going to get that in mainstream media? You're
gay,
not
male Filipino.
Oh, and specifically, yes. And like, so it's very, you are mapping that and you're putting that marker. This is what it is for me, triangulating it as this specific mm-hmm. identity that I have.
Yeah.
And is it something that is it something that's just natural to you? You have to be authentic, so that's where it comes from.
I have to write about race and sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I think because of the years of being Catholic and suppressing that, I'm making up for those lost decades. I think I've made up for it now, but...
I think you made up for it before, too.
But... I also, as I say, like the last 10 years, I've been writing very explicit, erotic, sexual, graphic
mm-hmm.
material of dating and sometimes loneliness and all of that stuff. And so this is why I'm sort of trying to open my world, and just I'm so conscious to the idea of erasure. I'm not the only one doing it, but the erasure that I've experienced and what I see in my world, it's I'm really hoping that I can probably, that'll be my next work, is to be able to, not so much about me, but what I see in the world, which is still about me, but, you know, it's sort of turning that lens, and also just survival, too. Everything, being a poet, that there's nothing that is logical about it. And so to be, everything says stop. Quit, don't do it. Everyone says, don't do it. They're not going to get you. They're not going to listen to you. They're not going to like this. This isn't really good. Like, you have nothing to say. Someone could say it better than you. But...
Or have you heard, like, oh, it's already been done?
It's already been done.
Of all things. You're like, which Filipino gay poet has done this before?
It's always going to be done, but so is racism. Mm-hmm. Racism is never going to end. I hate to say this. Mm-hmm. It will, like a bacteria or a virus, mutate. Mm-hmm. So that's all. As long as that exists, then the art needs to exist, and it's going to keep being done, because that's the only, I say it in a poem, and poetry can hold us up. So the idea that, like, essentially, I think Joy Harjo said that all poems are love poems. Mm. And when you have a society that understands poetry and writes poetry, you're going to get a world full of empathy and humility and courage and listeners and people who can listen to each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's missing in the schools. I don't think students are listening to each other. So when they come and we do a poetry workshop, and when it's done right and everyone listens to each other, mm-hmm. and they celebrate the difference, if in that classroom, if that can happen on the wider scale, that's where poetry can be effective. And, like, I'm biased because even more than painting and even more than dance and film, it's the idea of listening to each other didn't happen to me. And so if we can just change that, if we can make a poetry nation,
mm-hmm.
or a poetry, you know, world, that's what I'm all for. So I'm definitely a poetry advocate, as you are.
So you've been listening to Reggie Kabiko, and very happy to be having Reggie here.
I love you, Pamela K. Santos. Yay. It's a love fest. It's a queer Pinay love fest.
That was Reggie Kabiko. Pam, thank you so much for doing this interview.
You're welcome. For our third and final segment, we're kicking off the first of a recurring segment called Your English is So Good. If you're of Asian or Pacific Islander descent, someone's probably said something like this to you before. A variation could be, where are you really from?
So let's just get right into it. This is me talking to Jenna Yokoyama in the first segment of Your English is So Good. We both met her here at the KBOO newsroom because she's a volunteer. And Jenna's originally from Orange County, but has also lived in the Bay Area. And she's been in Portland for a few years now.
The one that bothers me a lot that I do get is they even skip over me and they say, where are your parents from? Because my English, you know, I have a California accent. So there's obviously this assumption that my parents must be from someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I definitely get the, where are you from?
Yeah.
Oh, no, where are your parents
what's
from?
Your,
what oh, is, where are your grandparents from?
What is your heritage?
Yeah, where's your heritage? And they,
is
and,
it ancient?
And well, this all the different variations that question gets. Where are you from? What is your ethnicity? What is your race? You know, where were your grandparents born is my favorite because my grandparents were born in Los Angeles. And so, and then people's faces freeze and they can't handle this idea that my grandparents were born here. One common thing I get is when I go to the grocery store, I've gotten this multiple times where when I buy some kind of meat at the meat counter, they ask me if I'm going to teriyaki that or what kind of stir fry are you going to make? And I just sort of stare at them and I smile, and then I tend to try to counter it with, oh, so you must know how to make a great hollandaise because you look super Euro.
Is that what you say in response?
I've said that a couple times and they don't seem to get it. Or they're like, oh, I do. I'm like, and you missed it. Yeah, but I definitely, I'll get that. Or I love when people, like, you know, they assume because I'm Asian, I must know everything Asian.
Right.
You know, so they're like, oh my God, can I ask you about where you can buy the best jasmine tea? I'm like, in the tea aisle. There's so, that sort of thing.
So what goes through your mind when something like that happens? And has that changed over time?
I think it's definitely changed as I've gotten older. When I was younger, you know, as a child, it was so much more common. I feel like in the 80s when I was growing up, I got a lot of comments, and it didn't really feel offensive because it was so much part of my everyday life that, and I wasn't raised to think that I should speak out against it. That's for sure. And then, you know, I think that's like a big part of the colored experience is you're taught to not speak out against it because of your fear of violence against yourself or being attacked. And I definitely still carry that feeling. One of the very many microaggressions I get are how I'm cute. Oh, you're so cute. My emotions are so cute. When I get angry, everything's cute because I'm small. And, oh, Asians are so cute, you know. So I often feel that I can't really speak up because I'll just be dismissed anyways. So maybe that might not be people's intention, but because I've gotten so many microaggressions over my life about being sexy, about being exotic, about being cute, about just constantly being a child when I'm an adult has made me, I think, hypersensitive to it. Actually had that at New Seasons the other day where I actually wasn't part of it, but there was a white man who said to a white woman with her baby, oh, when did you adopt your baby? When did you adopt him? He looks so unique. And she says, oh, actually the father is Korean. And then the man looks at her and says, hope he's not North Korean.
Wow.
I know. And I shot the look of death at him. And then I had that moment of, do I say something? Because I really wanted to say something. Yeah. I wanted to say, well, what if he was North Korean? We should all be so happy for that man that he got to get out of North Korea, you know? And like, how dare you? So my life has been in a theater. So I've definitely, that's where I've gotten a lot of microaggressions. Like I've been taught how to walk Japanese.
What is that?
Yeah, see, isn't that was my question when a theater director was like, you need to walk Japanese. And I said, what is that? Knowing exactly what he was going to do. He then stood up and walked across the stage like what I can only describe as one of those Fantasia mushrooms where he put his hands together and then just started doing this awkward up and down bowing motion. So I've been taught to walk Japanese multiple times in my life in theater. And I don't want to lose my job, so I smile and I do it. And that makes me feel terrible that I've done it, but I have fully done it. I've had many directors tell me the theater roles that I would be just perfect for, and they're always Madame Butterfly. I would not be perfect in Madame Butterfly.
Who's Madame Butterfly?
Madame Butterfly is one of the most racist operas by Verdi. Or is it by Puccini? I can't even remember who the opera is by. But Madame Butterfly, you know, is a story that takes place in Japan that is about the Japanese woman who falls in love with the great white soldier who comes over there. She kills herself at the end. Even though as an opera singer, that is not actually my voice type, I've been told that this is just perfect for me. And I say, it's because I'm Asian. Like, of course, there's just no ifs, ands, or buts around. They don't even hide it. Or I'm told, you'd be perfect in Miss Saigon. Have you been in The King and I? I'm like, yes, because no. Actually, I have been in The King and I. And I've always felt uncomfortable about that.
Right, yeah.
And that they also don't understand why I'm uncomfortable with that.
Are these things you've encountered in Portland or in California?
No, this is stuff I encountered in California. And I gave up theater. I gave up doing opera and theater in my mid-20s, largely because I was tired of that. I was really getting tired of being typecast. I was tired of being told that I was breaking ground for certain things and just stuff like that. And I felt really, really pigeonholed and very, very frustrated. So I left it.
Yeah. It would be really nice if people of color could just pursue their passions and do the things they liked without having to worry about, you know, do I belong here?
Or
is this for me? I think about that with radio sometimes too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Jenna, thanks so much. This is great. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's Jenna Yokoyama. I'm Alan Montecilio. We want to hear more from you. I'd love to make this a regular thing. So email us at pacificundergroundpdx@gmail.com. Or if you know either me or Pam, just let us know in whatever way works for you. Jenna, thanks again.
And that's our show. We did it.
Yes, we made it. All right, roll credits. This was great. Pacific Underground is produced by me and Pamela Santos. Thanks again to Christina Wong, Reggie Kabiko, and Jenna Yokoyama. Thank you to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon for letting us use their studio.
We get help from the members of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon's Arts and Media Project, especially Luann Algoso, Candace Keita, June Reyes, Dime Roberts, and Tony Tabora Roberts.
Our theme music is by Chops. The music you were hearing in between the segments is by Talila Marfil and Christina Wong. You can find their music on our website. It's kboo.fm/pacificundergroundpdx.
In just a little bit, to let you know, all of the music that we will be featuring is by API American artists.
Hell yeah.
Finally, let us know if you'd like to get involved. This is not the Alan and Pam show. This is about all of you. Email us at pacificundergroundpdx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at Pacific Podcast. You don't need to have radio experience to share your stories and talk about your issues.
And subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That's a thing people do, I think.
Thanks again for listening. I'm Pamela Santos.
And I'm Alan Montecilio. Thanks so much. See you next time.
The KBOO Community Radio Artist in Residence program assists artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The goals of the KBOO Artist Support Program are to support and invest in individuals who are pushing themselves artistically using sound, whose work will impact the cultural landscape of Portland, and to bring those artists into the dynamic KBOO community of local, national,